The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. You know, if you've ever found yourself arguing about politics, maybe about taxes or free speech limits, or, well, why we even have a government, You've actually been doing political philosophy. And today we're diving into the moral engine behind those debates, David Miller's Guide, Political Philosophy.
That's right. And our mission really is to walk you through Miller's map of these big political values.
Yeah.
You know, justice, freedom, authority.
Yeah, the things that get thrown around all the time in public life.
Exactly. But often used kind of loosely or inconsistently.
The book's idea is, well, it sounds simple, but it's actually pretty profound. Miller basically says, look, if you're a citizen in a democracy, understanding this stuff isn't a luxury.
No, it's a practical necessity. That's the core insight.
Okay.
If you don't get the philosophical roots of why you think the government should do this but not that, then you risk just making decisions based on, well, prejudice or emotion or just what's good for you personally.
Right. So understanding the foundations helps you move from just like shouting opinions to actually building reasoned arguments.
Precisely. It's about formulating ethical principles.
Okay, let's unpack this then. But before we get into the big ideas themselves, maybe let's talk about our guide here. David Miller, who is he?
Yeah, David Miller. He's genuinely a major figure in contemporary political philosophy. Spent four decades as a professor of political theory at Oxford?
Oh, yeah. Nuffield College.
Right. And his work covers a huge range. Social justice, democracy, nationalism, global justice. He's really shaped the conversation in those areas.
40 years thinking about this stuff. That gives him some serious authority. But what I find really interesting about him, what makes his work stick, is that he doesn't just stay up in the clouds, theoretically speaking.
Exactly. That's key. He's known for bridging abstract theory with, you know, urgent real-world political problems.
Okay.
Unlike some theorists who might stay purely abstract, Miller constantly grapples with actual policy issues.
Mm-hmm.
Like his work on nationalism that came about because he saw traditional liberal theory wasn't really dealing properly with how important shared national identity actually is for making modern societies work.
So he's not just like cataloging old ideas. He's actively trying to figure out how to build better political systems using sound principle.
Mm-hmm. And he manages to make these really complex, sometimes dense ideas accessible, but without dumbing them down.
Yeah, that's a hard balance.
It is. You get the sharp analysis, but also the practical takeaway.
Which makes his book, Political Philosophy, kind of perfect as both an introduction and a deeper dive into the core problems.
Definitely.
So the core thesis, boiling it down, the book tackles that huge question: how should we organize society and distribute power to create a just and legitimate political order?
Sounds simple. But it opens up a whole world of philosophical debate, doesn't it?
Yep.
And Miller structures it like a journey. He starts with the absolute most basic question any government has to answer. Why should anyone have the right to tell you what to do?
The question of political authority.
Exactly.
And from there, he works through legitimacy, justice, equality, freedom, rights, democracy, the whole set. What he's doing for you, the listener, is basically giving you a conceptual toolkit.
Yeah, a way to cut through the noise.
Right, to deconstruct political spin and actually form your own well-reasoned views.
And crucially, he doesn't assume you've studied philosophy before. He connects, say, 17th century debates about liberty straight to things we're dealing with now.
Like digital privacy or climate policy.
Precisely. It shows how these questions don't really go away. They just take new forms.
Okay, let's jump into that first big one then. Political authority. Why should you obey the state? Miller looks at the anarchist view first, right? The idea that any coercion is just wrong.
Mm-hmm. The challenge. And to answer it, philosophers use that classic thought experiment. What if there was no state? The state of nature.
Yeah, that thought experiment. It's kind of brilliant because it forces you to strip everything back and ask, what's government for?
Right. And the answers philosophers came up with are really different.
Yeah, drastically. You've got Thomas Hobbes. For him, the state of nature is just terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Pure thing.
The war of all against all. Life is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. So for Hobbes, authority is just about security, period. You give up everything to an absolute ruler just to survive.
Then you swing over to Locke, who's much more optimistic. He thought people have natural rights, life, liberty, property, even without government.
That's right.
But the problem is, without a neutral judge, disputes just spiral out of control. So we consent to a state to be that impartial referee. Authority comes from consent, and his job is to protect those rights.
Okay, so security versus consent and rights. And then there's Rousseau, who kind of throws another wrench in the works.
He does. Rousseau argues for something more radical. For him, real freedom isn't just being left alone or protected. It's living under laws that we ourselves have collectively created.
The general will.
That's the one. Authority is justified by this collective self-rule.
But that general will idea is tricky, isn't it? It's not just what the majority wants at any given moment.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be what the community would rationally choose if everyone was genuinely aiming for the common good, not just their own private interest.
Right. It's a shift from just being an obedient subject
to being an active, morally responsible citizen committed to the public good.
Okay, so three really different justifications for obeying the state. But hang on, even if we agree we need a state, the next massive argument is, how should that state decide who gets what?
Exactly. The focus shifts from obedience to fairness. And that brings us right into the huge challenge of justice.
This is where it gets really fascinating, I think. How do we distribute stuff fairly? Miller leans heavily on John Rawls here, right?
He does. Rawls' work was just monumental. He wanted to figure out the principles for a truly fair society, and he came up with this amazing thought experiment to force impartiality.
Ugh, the veil of ignorance. But, you know, how useful is that, really? Choosing rules without knowing anything about yourself, your class, talents, beliefs, it seems totally artificial.
Oh, yes, it's artificial, but that's the point. It forces you to think beyond your own self-interest. If you don't know whether you'll end up rich or poor, talented or not, part of the majority or a minority.
You have to pick rules that would be fair, even if you ended up in the worst possible position.
Exactly. It strips away bias and makes you think about genuine fairness for everyone.
Okay, so what principles did Rawls think rational people would choose behind this veil?
Two main ones. First, everyone gets the most extensive set of basic equal liberties compatible with similar liberties for others, like free speech, right to vote, that sort of thing.
Standard stuff.
Yeah. But the second one is the kicker, the difference principle.
Right. Explain that again.
It says that social and economic inequalities, differences in wealth or opportunity are only justified if they work to the greatest benefit of the least advantaged members of society.
So inequality is okay only if it helps with the poorest folks the most.
Pretty much. It's a powerful argument for a system where the economy is structured to specifically lift the bottom first. A philosophical defense of redistribution, really.
But Miller doesn't just leave it there. He contrasts Rawls with the main challenger, right? Robert Nozick.
Absolutely. Mm. Nozick's libertarian view, the entitlement theory, is the complete opposite in many ways.
How so?
For Nozick, justice isn't about the pattern of distribution, like whether it benefits the least advantaged. It's entirely about the process.
So how people got what they have.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Did they acquire it justly in the first place, like not stealing it?
Yeah.
Did they get it through voluntary exchange or gifts? If the history is clean, then however the wealth ends up distributed is just full stop.
And any attempt by the state to take from some to give to others
is a fundamental violation of property rights. Nozick famously compared it to forced labor.
Wow. Okay. That stark contrast really clarifies why debates about, say, progressive taxes are so fundamental. It's literally Rawls versus Nozick playing out.
It really is. Deep philosophical disagreements about what justice means.
Okay. So we've got authority. We've got justice. Let's move on to freedom. The limits of government power. Isaiah Berlin's distinction seems key here.
Oh, absolutely crucial. Berlin's two concepts of liberty. This really frames so much modern political argument.
First, there's negative liberty, freedom from.
Right. This is the classic liberal idea. Freedom means the absence of external barriers or constraints imposed by others, especially the state. Freedom from censorship, freedom from arbitrary arrest. You draw a line around the individual, and the state can't cross it without very good reason.
And the key principle for drawing that line is J.S. Mill's harm principle.
Exactly. Mill argued that the only justification for society interfering with an individual's liberty is to prevent harm to others.
Not harm to themselves, or just offending people.
Nope. If your actions only affect you, or if they affect others only with their consent, then society has no right to compel or restrict you. It's the cornerstone of individual autonomy.
Okay, that's negative liberty. But then there's positive liberty. Freedom, too.
This is different. It's not just about being left alone. It's about having the actual capacity or power to act, to pursue your goals, to realize your potential.
So, like, if you're technically free from interference, but you're so poor you can't afford education or healthcare.
Then, according to the positive liberty view, you're not truly free. You lack the resources, the opportunities to be self-governing or achieve self-realization.
And this might require the state to step in, not just stay out.
Precisely. It might justify state intervention, providing education, healthcare, social safety nets, to empower people, to give them the actual freedom to live fulfilling lives.
That distinction just lays bare the divide, doesn't it? Is government's job just to protect our private space, negative liberty? Or does it also have a duty to actively help us flourish, positive liberty?
That's the fundamental tension right there.
Miller also shows how philosophy has to evolve, right? It's not just about these classic individual-focused questions anymore. He talks about multiculturalism.
Yeah, this is a big challenge to traditional ways of thinking. Classic liberalism often aims to be difference blind. It treats everyone as an abstract individual with the same universal rights.
Which sounds fair on the surface.
It does. But the multicultural critique says, hang on, ignoring group differences often just means letting the dominant culture set the norms by default.
Oh.
So multiculturalism brings in the politics of recognition. This is the idea that certain groups might need public acknowledgement or support for their distinct cultural identities to achieve genuine equality.
Can you give an example? Like, what does that mean in practice?
Think about debates over funding for minority language schools, or exemptions from general rules for religious practices, like wearing specific attire in public institutions.
Right. The difference-blind approach would say same rules for everyone.
But the politics of recognition says that applying the same rule might actually disadvantage certain groups whose identities require different practices. It argues that true fairness sometimes requires acknowledging and accommodating difference, not ignoring it.
So Miller's approach is trying to find a balance.
Yeah, he's looking for ways to accommodate that kind of diversity, that need for recognition, but without undermining the shared civic identity that holds a democracy together. How do you support distinct groups without creating separation? It's a really complex balancing act.
Okay, let's try and pull out some core themes here. Connect it back to our everyday lives, which Miller insists we should do.
Right. Theme one, I think, has to be the practical relevance. We touched on this, but it's key.
Yeah. The reflection is, if you're arguing about, say, the minimum wage or environmental rules, you're doing philosophy. Miller forces you to ask, am I doing it well?
Exactly. Are my arguments consistent? What are the underlying values? Or am I just reacting?
Okay, theme two, the contestability of concepts. This was a big one for me.
Mm-hmm. Miller really hammers this home. Concepts like justice, equality, freedom, they don't have one single fixed meaning that everyone agrees on. They are essentially contested.
Which explains why political fights are often so deep, right? We're not just disagreeing about facts. We're disagreeing about what the words themselves mean or which interpretation we should prioritize.
Absolutely. It means we really have to think systematically about which values matter most to us and why.
And theme three, the tension between individual and collective.
Yes. This runs through absolutely everything we've talked about.
From authority Hobbes' absolute state versus Locke's individual rights.
To Justice Rawls focusing on the least advantage versus Nozick on individual property rights.
And freedom negative versus positive liberty. It's always there.
And seeing that tension helps you analyze real-world trade-offs. Like, think about public health rules during a pandemic versus individual freedom of movement or choice. It's that individual collective tension playing out.
The book is also packed with memorable ideas, almost like quotes that stick. Let's highlight a few.
Okay. Well, one that really defines the whole project is, philosophy asks not just what politicians are doing, but what they should be doing.
It's normative. It's about evaluation, principles, not just description.
Exactly. Another key one, especially from the justice section. Justice isn't just about the final outcome, the final distribution of wealth.
Right.
But about the processes and institutions that produce those outcomes. Are the rules of the game themselves fair?
That shifts the focus in a really important way.
And finally, maybe his point about democracy. Democracy is valuable not only because it might give us policies we like.
Although that helps.
Yeah, sure. But fundamentally, it's valuable because it respects us as equals, as people capable of governing ourselves. There's an intrinsic moral worth to participation itself.
Okay, so let's bring it right down to earth. How can we actually use this toolkit, like, tomorrow when reading the news?
All right, application one, critical news consumption. Say you're reading about a proposed tax reform. Use Miller's framework.
Okay.
Are the arguments being made primarily utilitarian, trying to maximize overall well-being or economic growth? Are they Rawlsian, focused on how it impacts the poorest? Or are they Nozickian, emphasizing property rights and non-interference?
Classifying the arguments helps you see the underlying philosophy.
Instantly. Application 2. Use the negative versus positive liberty lens to understand debates about government services.
Like healthcare or education funding.
Exactly. When one side argues for more government funding, they're often implicitly making a positive liberty argument the state needs to empower people. When the other side argues against it, often citing taxes or individual responsibility, that's usually rooted in negative liberty protecting freedom from state interference. It clarifies the deep philosophical split.
That's really useful. And a third one?
Apply Mill's harm principle to free speech debates. This is so relevant today.
Yeah, constantly in the news.
When people argue for restricting certain speech, ask, does this speech cause direct, demonstrable harm to identifiable others? Or is the objection based on offense or moral disagreement or potential indirect consequences?
Mill's principle gives you a benchmark, a standard to apply instead of just reacting to the content.
It provides a principled starting point, even if applying it is still difficult.
For me, the biggest takeaway was just the sheer power of those thought experiments, especially the veil of ignorance.
It really makes you think, doesn't it?
It just cuts through the usual self-serving arguments instantly. It forces a kind of intellectual honesty, makes these abstract ideas feel really concrete somehow.
And stepping back, looking at the bigger picture, Miller really demonstrates that political philosophy isn't some dusty academic subject. It's a continuous, practical way of reasoning.
Yeah.
It gives you, the citizen, the tools not just to watch the political game, but to actually understand it, critique it, and participate in it more thoughtfully. You start seeing the underlying values clashing in every news report, every policy debate.
The big lesson seems to be that engaging properly requires more than just gut feelings.
Right. It requires systematic reflection on principles.
Which does leave us with a kind of provocative thought, maybe. If these core concepts, justice, freedom, equality, are essentially contested, as Miller says, and maybe there isn't one single right answer to be found, does the goal of political philosophy change? Is it less about finding the truth and more about learning how to construct and evaluate the best possible arguments within those contested boundaries?
That's a great question to ponder. Does it become more about the quality of the reasoning than finding a final, settled conclusion? Something to definitely mull over.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Katra Foundation.